This episode of the Kona Edge is brought to you by Wheel Science. If you're looking for world-class carbon wheels that are UCI approved, come with a lifetime warranty and shipped free worldwide, then check out Wheel Science. Get all the performance at half the price, and when you use the coupon code KONAEDGE at checkout, you'll get an extra 10% discount. To learn more, head over to thekonaedge.com/wheels to find out more, or click on the link in your podcast player now. That's thekonaedge.com/wheels.
Welcome to the Kona Edge, where you'll discover what the best triathletes in the world do to give them the edge.
Welcome on to this edition of the Kona Edge. My name is Brad Brown, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you onto the podcast today. And we get to share another fantastic story as we head to Utah in the United States to catch up with Bryce Williams. Bryce, welcome onto the podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Brad. It's good to be here.
Bryce, I'm excited for this conversation because last week I got to share the story of a young Swede by the name of Rasmus Snorgerson. And Rasmus won his age group in Kona last year. He is a fifth-year med student. So you know what it's like racing Ironman as a med student. You're no longer a med student. That was a while ago. But you're an ophthalmologist by profession. It's turning into a bit of a medical week here on the Kona Edge today, this week.
That's great.
Bryce, tell me a little bit about your sort of background. And I know you mentioned in the email that you sent me that you came from a motorsport background. You used to ride motorcycles and, had a nasty accident and decided, you know what, maybe it's time to sell the bike. Tell me a little bit about that part of your journey.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up racing dirt bikes. My dad was into them quite a bit. And then, so he got me in at a fairly early age. And that was always a fun part of life to take the dirt bikes out. I grew up in a rural kind of farming community. So we could ride all over the place. And through the years, I took little breaks from riding dirt bikes and I got hurt a number of times. I've torn both ACLs and torn other ligaments and broken bones and things like that. And that's kind of par for the course for motocross. It's not a question of will you get hurt as much as when you get hurt and how bad. So by the time I was in medical school, I was pushing probably, 27, 28 years old. I had kind of a nasty crash and it put me in a sling for a while. And I was in the middle of medical school and I had a daughter that was maybe 9 months old and my wife. And so, yeah, at that point, just as a, with all the responsibilities that I had, I said, let's hang this up before I really get hurt. And so I sold the dirt bike and that was a sad day, but it was a necessary day.
isn't it amazing how, when you have kids, how you start questioning life decisions you made that were quite normal in your early 20s. And then you go, hang on a sec, maybe this isn't so wise.
That's right. Yeah. It changes your perspective for sure.
Bryce, before we get into the triathlon side of things, I mean, riding dirt bikes, people think, oh, it's a motorcycle. If you're sitting down, it's pretty easy. But, I mean, that sport is hectically physical. You've got to have some level of fitness to be fairly good at riding dirt bikes and motocross.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the most physically demanding sports there is. The guys that are professionals at it are very fit. And as a weekend warrior motocrosser, I suffered more on the weekends than I'd like to, because I didn't really know or had time to train during the week. And so we'd go and ride dirt bikes on Saturday, and then Sunday I'd always be sore, and Monday usually.
Your bicycle handling skills must be off the charts.
Yeah. Yes and no. So having a motor as a backup for when you get in trouble is a different animal than if you're out there on a mountain bike and you have to produce some pedal power. So I've had to relearn some of my skills, and it has gotten me in trouble a little bit, because I I think I'm really good, you know, at downhill mountain biking. And then I started to get out of control and you know, the bike handles differently when it only weighs, you know, 20 pounds versus a 150 pound motocross bike.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about the transition from motocross into triathlon. How did that happen?
Yeah, so my wife grew up doing some triathlons with her father, and I've always had a little bit of a need for a competitive outlet. And so when I sold the dirt bike, you know, I kind of tooled around a little bit. I went back to swimming just a little bit because I swam in high school and in college. And then, you know, my wife, when we moved back here to Utah, she and her dad were going to do a triathlon together. I said, oh, maybe I'll do that. You know, I know how to swim and I can kind of suffer through the rest of it. So borrowed a bike and did my first triathlon. And after that, I was hooked.
I was going to say, was it love at first sight, but it sounds like it was.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It fit perfectly for what I needed to have as far as a competitive outlet, and I tend to be more of an introvert, so I derive a lot of pleasure from just training by myself.
Yeah, and that I think, particularly when it comes to the Ironman distance, is probably a massive advantage from the mental perspective, being comfortable with spending time with yourself.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the training can sometimes turn people off to that longer distance race. But for me, I enjoy the long rides, the long trainer rides. It doesn't bug me to be in my little room for 5-6 hours just pulling away.
That first triathlon, what distance was it? Was it a sprint? Was it Olympic?
It was a sprint, yeah.
So why the step up to the long stuff? I mean, like you say, you don't mind it, but what's the real attraction?
I think I'm more competitive at the longer distance. I never had the leg speed to pull off a, you know, 15 or 16 minute 5K, but I have the mental grit to, you know, grind out a marathon at slower paces. And just suffer through it. So I'm a little more competitive at the longer distance.
Where do you think that mental grit has come from, Bryce?
You know, a little bit of just as a, you know, as a kid, I learned to kind of take care of myself a little bit. My dad and my parents divorced when I was young, and I went and lived with my dad, and he was a pilot. And in sixth grade, there were days where I wouldn't have any parental oversight, and I had to, so there was a little bit of growing up at an early age and learning to kind of just make things do with what you can and not worry too much about how life throws things at you.
And where do you think your competitive spirit comes from?
Probably the motocross, and my dad's very competitive as well, and he kind of taught me some of that stuff, and you know, it's part of growing up, I believe. Motocross, yeah.
Do you think those two characteristics are key if you want to be good at Ironman triathlon and particularly qualifying and racing on the Big Island?
I do believe the mental toughness needs to be there. As far as the competitive spirit, I don't know that you have to necessarily feel like you have to beat other people. However, the competitiveness with yourself, I believe, is crucial and a key component. So being able to push yourself to the next level because you know in the past you've achieved that sort of a level and you want to continue to progress. So, you know, I don't get a lot out of saying, oh, I want to go out and beat this guy or beat that guy, but I do want to go out and perform better than I have in the past. And so it's more of a competition with myself.
Do you tend to run those sort of cycles season by season, or how do you structure that within your training and your racing?
How do I structure the competitive cycles?
Within yourself, trying to be better than you were last time out.
Yeah, it's usually by build. And so, you know, my last Ironman build was for Kona. And so this current build is for Texas. And I can kind of look back on Training Peaks and say, okay, I was at this stage last time at this week. And am I, you know, at the same stage or maybe a little bit ahead? And that's how I can kind of compare to my previous training.
When did Ironman first come onto your radar after that first sprint? Was it a sort of logical progression up the distances, or was it a, you know, that was cool, I want to go do Ironman?
It was more of a logical progression. I did have a little bit of a coach. He was more of a he wasn't really hands-on, but he's a little bit, and he had done a lot of Ironmans, and he kind of guided me through the process. He's like, you know, you want to start with the low distance stuff and get your body used to the demands of Ironman training. And having a swim background, I really needed to go a little bit slower perhaps than others, because I hadn't developed the resilience to the run durability that's required for Ironman.
And correct,
so I went slow.
Correct me if I'm wrong as well, yeah. But your swimming background was a lot more of the shorter, faster stuff. It wasn't the longer stuff. So it's easy probably then when you started, one of your strengths, and you'd go, you know what, I'm going to smash this thing, but then you've still got another 180 Ks and a 42K run to take care of.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, swimming's a little bit of a different animal than the other sports in that even though I was a sprinter, I trained in the era when we would routinely do 10,000 yards a day. Even though my race was a 50-yard or 100-yard race, boy, our coaches just had us out there in the pool forever. So I had a lot of aerobic, capacity and some background with longer distance in the pool, but I didn't have any kind of biking or running background.
Tell me about that first Ironman experience.
So the deal was that I couldn't race an Ironman until I had finished my residency, so my medical training, and that finished in July, the first week of July, and I raced Vineman like the last week of July. So it was like 3 weeks. So I had been itching for it, but I held off until I was done with residency, and back then it was not an Ironman branded race. It was just a, you know, local kind of fun race, and so signed up for that one, and I remember being super scared of the marathon and thinking there's no way I could run 26 miles. And the old Vineman was not a easy course. It was very hilly. And even the run, there was a fair amount of elevation change. It was a lot like Kona actually without the humidity. And the swim went fine. And then the bike was fine. I had that coach that kind of helped me through that. And then actually I got through most of the run, and about mile like 20 or so, I'm like, wow, I can actually still run this. It shocked me. And I ended up going like 10 hours and 40 minutes or something. But I felt pretty good afterwards. I knew I could have gone harder, gone faster. But at that point I was like, okay, this is a fun thing. It didn't destroy me. And I was hooked on doing more. At that point,
isn't it amazing how at times in that run you probably said to yourself, I think we all have, I'm never going to do this again, this is horrible, I never want to do it again, and shortly after you cross that finish line, you're plotting your next assault to see how you can go faster.
that's true. I compare it to a pregnancy and giving birth. Women, you know, that bless their hearts, I don't know how they get through this, but you go through 9 months of pregnancy and it totally sucks. And then you go through this birthing process and that totally sucks. But then within a 4 or 5 months after, they're like, you know, I think I could do that again. So somehow the brain is demented that way.
Yeah. I think our memories as human beings, there's definitely some issues there. There's a sports scientist based here in South Africa. I think a lot of people may know the name, Professor Tim Noakes, who's based here in Cape Town. And he wrote about an ultra marathon here in South Africa called the Comrades Marathon. It's an iconic ultra marathon, and it's brutal. The hills are crazy. And he says that in one of his books, he says that if people remembered pain, you would only ever run Comrades once. And I think it's the same for an Ironman, that if you actually remembered the horrible bits, I don't think we'd go back for more than one.
Probably true.
Talk to me about when you realized, you know what, I'm pretty good at this thing and I could possibly go and race on the Big Island.
Well, that came, so that was probably my second Ironman race. That was Maryland. And what I had done is I hired a coach, Doug McLean with QT2 Systems. And he took me and I hired them because they I agreed with their approach of heart rate training and kind of the more aerobic based type demand. And so I hired Doug, and he walked me through Maryland, and I really didn't think I had any chance at Kona. I just wanted to go a little faster than I had before. But then when I finished the race, I think I took fifth place at that race. I went like a 9:27, and I still didn't qualify for Kona because they only gave out like two or three slots at that race. But it was when I finished that race, that's when I realized, okay, I'm in the conversation. You know, I missed it, but not by much. But that's, I started to get some running injuries at that point. So I had to back off. I got a little plantar fasciitis and ran through it. And I didn't really understand this running injury issue that I was going to be facing for the rest of my Ironman training stuff. But that was the race that kind of said, okay, maybe you have a shot at this. Yeah.
Tell me about the attraction to Kona. When you speak to any age grouper and it's, you mention the word Kona and it conjures up a whole bunch of emotions. For you, if I say Kona, what does it make you think of and why are you so attracted to that place?
Well, it's changed over the time. So in the beginning, it was more, I want to be able to go and say that I earned it on my own and just go and enjoy it. Not, you know, just so when, you know, when I say, okay, did you reach kind of the big dance? Yep, I did that. And that was the goal. But then now that I've gone, I've raced twice, I've qualified three or four times, and I placed last year, and it's become more of the race that brings all the competition, and it challenges yourself to the limit because of the not only the depth of the field but the conditions of the race, and so the qualifying races are fun and they're great, but Kona is really where the test happens for me now. So now it's more of that I want to get there so that I can, you know, show myself what I can do. Yeah.
I find it interesting that you've raced twice, but you qualified more than that. You've turned down slots, which is, I find that interesting because I mean, I know people who would absolutely die to go to Kona and they struggle to qualify. You've had the opportunity and you've turned it down for whatever reasons. And I'm guessing it could be various things. You've got a family, you've got a full-time job, so there's time commitments and that sort of thing. Tell me the thought process behind turning down a slot on the Big Island.
The times that I've turned it down, I've had to decide that I was going to do that before the race. Because in the heat of the moment, you're probably going to take it, right? But you're exactly right. It was for family commitments. It was for other things that were happening around the same time of the race that I knew that if I'd taken the slot, I would, because of my personality, I would probably sacrifice the wrong thing in order to race better. And so before the race even happened, I said to myself, if I do qualify, I'm going to turn the slot down because my family's more important to me and my other responsibilities that I need to take care of first. And there's always going to be another Kona. Hopefully, I mean, you never can really assume that you could be injured or, you know, life could change where you don't have that chance again. And you have to be okay with that possibility.
Yeah.
Before the race.
Yeah. And that's interesting. It would be a totally different story if it was your first time to qualify that you went, you know what, I'm not going to take it. Cause you aren't guaranteed. You don't know if tomorrow is going to be there or not. So, but I love the fact that it's a calculated decision and it's before the race. and it's what's best for you and your family long term. Because, and I'm asking this question because you're probably one of the people that I speak to that is in this, that you've got a very high sort of, I don't want to say power job, but you have to be there. It's not like you can delegate your position to anybody else. You've got a family. It takes a lot of training to qualify for Kona and be competitive on the Big Island. And when you're in a big build to Kona, something's got to give. You've got to make sacrifices, and it might be work, it might be family, but if you want to be competitive, it can't be your training. So there's got to be some balance at some stage. How do you get that juggle right?
That's been a process. In the beginning, it was imbalanced towards triathlon. And over the years, I think my wife and I have been able to come up with a nicer balanced approach. It's involved. And here's the other problem is it takes years to develop the resilience and the body that can train for and race an Ironman at a competitive level. So there has to be some upfront imbalance, I think, before you can back off a little bit on the training hours and still be competitive. So there, if you're going to take like a long-term, you know, 5 or 10 year approach, you may have to sit down with your family in the beginning and say, look, there's going to be 2 or 3 years where I am going to dedicate more time than I will have to in the future in order to be at that competitive level. And if they're okay with that, then as you develop as an athlete, you can decrease the total volume, increase your intensity, still be competitive, and also your body develops the ability to absorb the training at a faster rate, so you don't need to put it as many weeks before the race, and you increase your stress bucket, if you will, so that you're not such a zombie walking around those last 2 months before the race. You can actually interact with your kids and play with them and still train at that high level.
You forgot to say walking around like a zombie looking for food, because that's what it's like those 2 weeks.
That's right.
Bryce, I'm fascinated by that, and I agree with you. And I think that is partly one of the reasons why we see so many athletes burst onto the scenes. They're competitive, and then you never see them again. They're there for a season or two, and then they're gone, and they've burnt themselves out. And I think, I'm not saying one approach is better than the other, but if you're going to be around the sport for a long time, I think the approach that you take is probably the approach that you should be taking.
Yeah, it's worked well for our family. And each time I build for an Ironman, it's better than the previous one on my family and on me. And I look forward to it getting even better and better. But there is that upfront kind of cost, and you have to be patient with yourself as you develop as an athlete. Yeah.
What are you most proud of in your triathlon journey?
Well, that's a good question. I would probably say last year's Kona. I was shocked that I took fifth place in the age group. In fact, I didn't think I had a chance at that. And I had booked tickets to go to Maui Sunday morning. And I tried to, after the race, I called the airlines and tried to switch it, but it was like $4,000 or $5,000. It was a ridiculous amount of money. So I didn't even make it to the award ceremony.
Oh, no.
That's how I was out in left field thinking that I could even podium at Kona. So that was probably my happy, you know, like kind of the pinnacle. And I don't think I'll ever be able to do that again. I mean, you never know, right? But I was able to train without an injury. And there were a couple other guys in my age group that did have injuries that took them out of the race. And so that's what I think allowed me to step in a little.
Well, let me ask you this question. And I think it follows on quite nicely from there. How much of your success in the sport of triathlon do you put down to pure genetics, hard work, and a bit of luck?
Well, at my level, I think hard work is number one. And genetics would be number two, you know, but at a professional level, it's probably, those might be 50-50. But you know, for a normal mortal like myself and the rest of us age groupers, I think hard work is going to play a huge role, and smart work in addition to hard work. And then, yeah, you know, obviously there's some genetic abilities there, and not everybody's genetically able to be at that competitive level. And then luck plays a role in the race, in your race outcome for sure. I don't think it plays much of a role in your training, at all, really, but in the race outcome. And that's why you can't hinge your feeling of success, your definition of success, on race outcomes. You have to be able to be okay with controlling the controllables. And if you get a flat tire, which is what happened to me my first year at Kona, I got 2 flat tires. But because my definition of success was not, oh, where am I going to place in the age group, I enjoyed the race the whole time and actually did okay. And I was super happy with the outcome of the race because my definition of success is not based on uncontrollable variables.
And if you do what you can do and it's good enough to get you a podium, then so be it. If not, you still achieve what you set out to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what gives you longevity in the sport.
How long do you think you'll still be around doing it? Are you going to be one of those guys in your 80s?
You never know. For the time being, it's my passion. And I really enjoy it. And I think we've achieved a balance that works for my family at this point. But, you know, in the future, as my kids get a little older, they may be a little more demanding as far as time goes. And I may have to step away from the long distance. I think I could still do half distance races on much less training. But yeah, for now, it's my passion.
What do you think the biggest challenge is facing the sport right now that I mean, it's in a massive growth spurt, but what do you think is something that could scupper that growth and everyone's love for the sport?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's going to continue to grow and get more popular. I would say the challenge would be to cater to the masses and, you know, be able to encourage participation on all levels, regardless of your athletic background and your interests. So here in Utah, we have a lot of mountain biking. We do have an Xterra race, but gravel events, I think, are going to become more popular. And I think the triathlon needs to absorb some of those other interests to pick up additional people that may otherwise be, you know, shied away from the sport. Swimming seems to be a big barrier for people, and I don't know how to bridge that, you know. But for a lot of people, the swim is what scares them from, you know, participating.
Because you make a very interesting point there too, Bryce. With that swim, that Ironman as a business obviously have to cater for the weakest swimmer, because if they get it wrong, people die, and you can't have that in an event. But one of the big criticisms is the loss of the rolling starts. I mean, Kona, you have that mass start, which is special. But I remember my first couple of Ironmans were mass starts, and I was an okay swimmer, and it didn't bug me too much, but I knew it petrified the living daylights out of some people. And I feel that racers lose something on those rolling starts. There's something about standing on that line with 1,500 other people singing a national anthem or listening to someone else's national anthem, and the gun goes and everyone runs to the water. I think that's missing from the sport. But like you say, the swim is the barrier. How do you get that balance right?
Yeah. I think some races do the rolling start to cater to those folks that are really nervous about the swim. And then other races keep them as a mass start, and keep Kona as a mass start forever. You know, never change that. That's a tough balance. And then you also run into logistical challenges, and take Texas, for example. it's not an organized, it is a rolling start, but it's not an organized rolling start where you're really spreading people out. Like St. George half, you know, you're starting age groups every, I think, 5 or 10 minutes, and that really spreads people out. But in Texas, unfortunately, because you kind of throw everybody into the water in a period of like 2 or 3 minutes, the bike becomes a logistical nightmare to police drafting. And so that might be a race where it would make more sense to do a rolling age group start where you're putting everybody and really spreading them out over a period of an hour. That makes the bike a lot more easy to police and referee. But I agree with you. It's a tough call.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be the one making those calls, that's for sure. You mentioned drafting, and that, I think, is one of the big challenges. And Texas, every single year, I mean, the photos show up on social media and everyone has their 2 cents worth to say. But another thing that seems to be becoming more prevalent is doping in age grouping ranks. How big a problem do you think that is?
You know, that's a good question. I'm kind of an optimist, and I hope that it's not as prevalent as some people feel it is. I've talked to some professionals, triathletes, and they feel like it's just everybody's doing it, in both the professional and the age groups. You know, I honestly have no clue how prevalent it is. And that's a difficult thing to police as well. It looks like they're trying to make inroads a little bit on more frequent testing. I would be all for paying a little extra on my entry fee to make it mandatory for anybody that qualifies for Kona and anybody that's on the podium at Ironman to be tested, at the time of the race. And if they go to Kona, then everybody has to be tested at some point randomly during outside of competition. And, you know, that might be an extra $20 for everybody's entry fee to pay for that. But I would be all for that. And I think there's a petition going around that people are signing to try and get that into policy. But I think if we tested more frequently, people would not do it.
Yeah, it's an issue. I don't know the answer to that question either, but again, I don't get why age groupers would dope. It's not like they're setting themselves up financially, and it's all about, you know what, I finished on a podium or I won a race. At the end of the day, there's so much more, in my opinion, there's so much more to life than sort of nailing your colors to that mask, and that's where you sit.
Yeah, I agree. I really don't think it's as prevalent as some people think. I'm sure there's some guys out there doing it, but, you know, good for them, I guess, if they feel like that's okay. And that gets them a little bit better. I'm not sure. I'm a little, skeptic about how much it really helps an age grouper. You know, the professionals, you know, the difference between first place and like 30th place is minutes, right? I mean, that's where doping is going to really make a difference for that level. But for an age grouper, you know, the difference between me going to Kona and maybe not going to Kona in some races can be, you know, 20, 30 minutes, which I don't know if doping is going to really increase someone that's at my level that, you know, we're not pushing the absolute envelope. And so I don't know. It would be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just, I think that's human nature, is wherever there's some sort of competition, people are trying to cut corners. I guess that's just the way it is. Bryce, it's been great catching up. I look forward to talking about your individual disciplines, but we'll save that for another time. Thanks for your time on the Kona Edge today.
My pleasure.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge, I want to invite you to check out the Coach Parry Training Club. The Coach Parry Training Club is the essential resource for anyone at any stage of their triathlon journey. Whether you're just starting out in the sport and training for your first sprint distance race, or if you've been around the block a few times and are looking to take your Ironman performance to the next level, then the Coach Parry Training Club can help you. Developed by Double Olympic and Commonwealth Games triathlon coach Lindsay Parry and myself, the Coach Parry Training Club is the go-to online platform for your training needs. It's like having a coach in your pocket. Get 20% off when you join the Coach Parry Training Club by using the coupon code KONA at checkout. Head over to thekonaedge.com/coach or click on the link in your podcast player now. That's thekonaedge.com/coach.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for The Kona Edge.